Chapter 17, and you can be seated. Let me open the teaching time with prayer. Father, I pray that you would help me to use your strength. And I pray that as we meditate on this seems like a worn out story that everybody's heard, I pray that you would bring fresh faith to us to be reminded to trust you and not be overwhelmed by the challenges that you allow to come into our lives. I pray that you would help us to have the attitude that David did of being concerned about your glory and not being afraid of man. Pray this in Jesus' name. Amen. Well, I'm not going to be able to get through the whole story of David and Goliath in one session here. So for now, I want to focus on the setup to the David and Goliath story in the first half of chapter 17 of 1 Samuel. I want to focus on the stalemate, the anatomy of that stalemate that was going on that David entered into. And I want to encourage you to think about, apply that to your life in terms of the spiritual stalemates and the kind of thinking and attitude it takes to overcome them. When David showed up in the Israelite army camp on an errand, he found his nation's army paralyzed, unwilling to make a move. In our lives, that kind of thing can also happen. Maybe it's a struggle with a besetting sin, and it doesn't go away. It seems more powerful than anything you can do to resist it or overcome it. Seems the sin will never be conquered, and you're just doomed to live uneasily with it for the rest of your life, not knowing how to break the stalemate. Perhaps you see it in the larger culture, systems of oppression and wickedness. Christians may agree they're bad, but what can you do about them? The federal government subsidizes the promotion of abortions. I've been in the movement, the pro-life movement, for as long as it's existed. and it seems like it's just impossible to overcome. Or the way our nation's public schools and universities have so effectively organized to convert all their students to the religion of secular humanism. What can you do? It's too big a system to change. Or the way that truth is censored and propaganda is promoted by the biggest mass media companies in our nation. And people can't even figure out what's the truth anymore and what's a lie. The companies are so gigantic and are so powerful in their control all communication. It's like, what can you do? Christians haven't seemed to make much headway on these fronts. Feels like it's always going to be this way. We're doomed to stand by helplessly with our hands at our sides, just watch it all fall apart. Like the have any of you read the book Animal Farm, where the donkey knows what's going on, but he warns people, but he can't do anything about it. It's just everything's going to hell in a handbasket. Well, I want you to notice the attitude that David has as he encounters this stalemate. I'm going to read the first half of 1 Samuel 17. Presently, the Philistines mobilized their positions for combat.
They mobilized at Socah, which belongs to Judah, and they took a position between Socah and Azekah in Ephes-Damim. So Saul and each man of Israel mobilized themselves and took a position in the valley of Elah, and they formed battle ranks to encounter the Philistines. Now the Philistines were standing at one slope from this valley, and Israel was standing at that slope from this valley, and the ravine was between them. Then the middleman came out from the position of the Philistines. His name was Goliath from Gath. His height was more modern versions say 6 cubits plus a span, and a helmet of bronze was upon his head. With scale armor he was clad, and the weight of the body armor was 5,000 shekels of bronze. And there were bronze shin guards on his legs, and a bronze javelin slung between his shoulders. Moreover, the shaft of his spear was furrowed like weavings, and the tip of his spear was 600 shekels of iron. There was also the man who carried his full body shield walking before him. And he stood and called out to the ranks of Israel and said to them, "Why are you all coming out to form battle ranks? Is it not so that I am the Philistine, and you all are servants to Saul? Choose for yourselves a man and let him come down to me. If he is successful in combat with me, that is, if he strikes me down, then we shall become the servants to y'all. But if it's me who's successful over him, that is, if I strike him down, then y'all shall become the servants to us, and y'all shall serve us." And the Philistine also said, "As for me, I insult the ranks of Israel this day. Give me a man. Let's engage in combat together." And when Saul and all Israel heard these words from the Philistine, they became dismayed. They're very afraid. Now, David was the son of a certain Ephrathite man from Bethlehem of Judah, and his name was Jesse. And he had 8 sons, and during the days of Saul, he advanced among the men to be an elder. And the 3 oldest sons of Jesse went and followed after Saul to the battle. The names of his 3 sons who went to the battle were Eliab the firstborn, Abinadab the second, and Shammah the third. But as for David, he was the youngest. Anyway, the 3 oldest followed after Saul, but David was going and returning from attending Saul to shepherd his father's flock at Bethlehem. Meanwhile, for 40 days, the Philistine approached each morning and evening and took his station. Presently, Jesse said to David, his son, "Please take a bushel of this granola and 10 of these bread loaves and run them over to the army position for your brothers. And bring these 10 churns of milk to the officer over their 1,000. And visit your brothers for peace and get their good news. Saul and they and the men of Israel are all in the valley of Elah at war with the Philistines." So David rose early in the morning and left the sheep with a keeper and took the things and went as Jesse had commanded him. And he came to the camp as the army was going out to the fight and shouting for the battle. For Israel and the Philistines had drawn up in battle array, army against army. And David left his supplies in the hand of the supply keeper, ran to the army, and came and greeted his brothers. Then as he talked with them, there was the champion, the Philistine of Gath, Goliath by name, coming up from the armies of the Philistines. And he spoke according to the same words, and David heard them. And when everybody from Israel heard the man, they fled then from his presence, and they were very frightened. And each man of Israel said, "Have you all seen this man coming up? For sure he's coming up to insult Israel. But it's going to happen that the man who strikes him down, the king will give him the greatest wealth and will give in marriage his daughter to him. And he will make his father's house free in Israel." So David spoke to the men standing with him, saying, "What's going to be done about the man who's going to strike this Philistine and turn away the insult from upon Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should insult the ranks of the living God?" And the people spoke to him according to this statement, saying, "Thus it shall be done for the man who strikes him down." But Eliab, his oldest brother, heard it while he was talking to the men, and Eliab's anger blazed toward David, and he said, "For what reason did you come down? And with whom did you leave that little flock in the wilderness? As for me, I know your insolence and the badness that belongs to your heart, for it was in order to see the combat that you came down. But David said, what have I done now? Isn't this the issue? And then he stepped around from being next to him to get in front of another person, and they talked about this statement, and the people repeated a statement like the first one. I'll stop the story at that point. Saul's army is facing off against the Philistine army across a ravine. There's a picture of it in modern times. Named Elah, which means oak or terebinth. So it's probably named after the trees that were there. The valley belonged to the Israelite tribe of Judah. So the Philistines have encroached upon Israelite land. This valley runs east-west in the Shephelah borderlands that go from the hill country of Bethlehem, Judah, down to the coastal plain where the Philistines lived. So it was in that border area on the slopes. So you have these valleys, runoff valleys, that go down to the Mediterranean Ocean. It was the natural point of entry from the Philistine homeland into the hill country of Saul's kingdom. So this was a crucial battle. And Azekah was a city that controlled the main road through that valley. But the armies were in deadlock. They sat for over a month, drawn up in formations against each other, without fighting. Now, we're not told why the Philistines refrained from attacking. Matthew Henry suggested that it might be because they realized their army was too small. And they were afraid they would lose again if they entered pitched battle, so they were trying an alternative of a single combat. Don't know that for sure. But we do have some explanation in the Bible as to why the Israelites sat on their hands. And the main reason given is that challenge that Goliath was issuing. A lot of detail is given to the description of the Philistine champion that offered to engage in one-on-one combat with any Israelite soldier in lieu of a battle between the two armies. And normally I would focus more of my sermon on spiritual things, on what God is doing, but the point of this story, a big point of this story, is realizing how people were thinking and responding to the physical threat. So I want to spend a little time on the physical threat of Goliath. Now, if I were to ask you to describe Goliath, probably the first word that comes to your mind is the word giant, but the Bible never actually calls Goliath a giant. It does say that he was a descendant of a giant in 2 Samuel 21. And we do know that from Joshua 11:22 that there was a connection between giants and the Anakim, and that these Anakim lived in Gath, which is Goliath's hometown. And we have a statement about how tall he was, and he was tall. So maybe he was a giant. All the earliest known manuscripts say that Goliath was 4 cubits in a span tall. So that's somewhere upwards of 6.5 feet tall. It wasn't until about 400 AD that manuscripts began exaggerating the height to 6 cubits. The Anastasi papyrus, there's an image of that on the screen here, is from this same time period, 13th century BC, and describes Canaanite warriors whom the Egyptians called Shasu, and says that they were 4 to 5 cubits in height, which would exactly match the earliest known manuscripts of this describing Goliath at 4.5. But the 4 to 5 cubits in height, the Egyptians considered that to be impressively tall. Whereas Egyptian artwork, if you've seen how they do the ancient Egyptian artwork, they'll make their pharaohs and their noblemen really big, and they make servants really small in the drawings. But they made an exception when it came to these giants, these Shasu. at the bottom of the screen, you can see a carving that was made in the 13th century BC under Ramses II, depicting two Shasu spies that they beat in a raid against the Hittites. And you can see those two guys in the middle are a lot taller than all the Egyptians that are standing around them beating them. They were very impressed with how tall these people were. Goliath's height was imposing. But this gave God's people the opportunity to put into practice what God had told Samuel in chapter 16, verse 7. Don't make your observations based on his looks or based on his imposing height, because I've rejected him. For God doesn't see the way man sees. Man only sees to the extent of the eyes. God sees to the extent of the heart. Goliath was so big and strong, he could wear a 125-pound coat of armor or a breastplate. Looked like fish scales. Plus other pieces of armor on his head and legs. People estimate weighed upwards of 200 pounds altogether. And he could still fight other people with that much weight on him. He was strong. In the National Archaeological Museum of Athens, this Mycenaean warrior vase can be found. It's dated to the 12th century BC, so also the same time period. And it depicts warriors that are wearing the same greaves and bronze helmet and coats of mail that Goliath is described as wearing in 1 Samuel. His defensive armor is all made of bronze. That's a compound of copper and tin. And the tin would, as I understand it, was mostly imported from Europe. The Hebrew word can also mean brass, but brass is technically a compound of copper and zinc, as I understand it, and they didn't have zinc back then to work with. Goliath's paired spear and javelin match the Egyptian depictions at Medinet Habu of these sea peoples, who the Philistines were sea peoples, who invaded the northern coast of Egypt in the same era. And the Egyptian accounts describe these invaders carrying two spears. The huge spear, according to an archaeologist that wrote an article about this in the Bible and Spade magazine, it was a hallmark of Bronze Age weaponry in the Aegean area and the Balkan Peninsula as well, which does seem to indicate their ethnic roots were from there. The Philistines had migrated to settle fairly recently in Palestine. The javelin had loops or leashes of cord tied to it, like the frame of a loom. A loop and a cord wound around the shaft so that the weapon could be hurled a greater distance with greater stability, because it would spin. You'd wind the leather thong around it, and when they threw it and held onto the leather thong, it would cause a axial spin. It gave more stability to the spear. Another possible interpretation of this likeness of the spear to a weaver's beam, you may have noticed in my translation, I translated it, so what was it, grooves like weavings or something. Hebrew lexicons trace the root of that Hebrew word beam, the translated beam, to a verb that means to till the soil. And furthermore, the Hebrew word translated weaver is not singular but plural, so I think it could be more accurately translated plural weavings. And that sounds to me like rifling. Grooves in the shaft that are also for improved aerodynamics. The tip of his spear alone was over 15 pounds. I don't know how. Who has a baby that's 15 pounds now? Is that okay? Can you imagine putting that weight 10 feet out on the end of a beam? And how would you even hold that? I mean, the torque with 15 pounds, 10 feet out on a beam is going to be incredible. The strength that he had to have had to manage that. Now, he probably had a counterweight on the other end also, probably another 15 pounds on the other side so that the spear is balanced. But that's heavy. How would he even throw that? To figure out what it would be like to be hit by Goliath's spear, I consulted with Wesley Ulmer, who's a ballistics expert with the U.S. Army and now trains our local police in ballistics. And here was his assessment. He said, there's a website called goliathsspear.com, and they put the spear at 33 pounds, 12 ounces. In their mock-up, they used a 10-foot-long red oak shaft with a 6-pound counterweight. If you use a rigid spear thrower, people can get spears going around 93 miles per hour. So Wes said, I used 100 miles per hour as the spear's speed at impact, accounting for Goliath's strength and skill as a champion warrior. Firearms ballistics use the following equation to figure kinetic energy. Half the bullet weight in grains times velocity in feet per second squared. So if we have 33¾ pounds for the spear, that's 236,250 grains. Ever loaded a bullet with that big? 100 miles per hour would be 146 and two-thirds feet per second. And these numbers would bring the kinetic energy up to 11,282.1 foot-pounds of energy. And I asked Wes, what would be the equivalent in terms of modern firearms to 11,000 foot-pounds of energy? And I'll put it before you. Would the equivalent be an AR-15 machine gun round, a .30-06 high-powered rifle, or a 50 caliber BMG or M2. Who thinks it would be equivalent to the AR-15? Who thinks it would be equivalent to a .30-06 getting hit with Goliath's spear? He says 50 calibers. 50 calibers is correct. AR-15 machine gun round can hit 1,200 foot-pounds, so one-tenth of what Goliath's spear would hit you at. 30-06, which is powerful. You girls got to shoot a 30-06, didn't you, a couple weeks ago? That thing had a kick. I mean, it's big. But still, only a quarter of what Goliath could have hit you with. The 50 caliber BMG is the largest rifle the Army uses. And that is the range of jewels that you would have been hit with if you'd been hit with Goliath's spear. We haven't come that far as we might have thought in 3,000 years of weapons. And unlike the kind of spears you hear of used by tribes in the jungles of Africa and Amazon even today, nobody would be able to keep on running after getting hit with that spear. It was designed not only to pierce, but to knock down. Perhaps more likely to shatter the shield of the opponent so that you could grab the other spear and kill him once his spear was obliterated. Goliath was huge. He was strong enough to carry heavy weaponry. He was almost completely covered in metal armor. Plus, he had a shield bearer that carried a big full-body shield that you'd have to get past that guy before you even get to Goliath. 19th century Scottish Presbyterian minister Robert Jamieson commented, "In consequence of their great size and weight, the Oriental warrior had a trusty and skillful friend whose office it was to bear the large shield behind which he avoided the missile weapons of the enemy. He was covered cap a pie with defensive armor, while he had only two offensive weapons, a sword by his side and a spear in his hand." This is what they're up against. It's intimidating. On top of that, Goliath had a foul mouth with which he defied insulted or challenged or mocked. That word gets a lot of different translations across different versions. He expressed contempt for the people of God. Verse 11 says that in the face of all this, Saul and all the men of Israel, when they would hear these words from the Philistine, they became dismayed, and not just frightened, but very frightened. Now, these two Hebrew words for dismayed and afraid have already occurred four times together in the Bible in a very different way. Deuteronomy 1:21 says, "Look, the Lord your God has set the land before you. Go up and possess it, as the Lord God of your fathers has spoken to you. Do not fear or be dismayed." Deuteronomy 31:8 says, "And the Lord, he is the one who goes before you. He will be with you. He will not leave you or forsake you. So do not fear or be dismayed." Joshua 8:1. "Now the Lord said to Joshua, do not be afraid nor be dismayed. Take all the people of war with you and arise and go up to Ai. See, I've given you into their hand, given into your hand the king of Ai, his people, his city, his land." Joshua 10:25, Joshua said to his men, "Do not be afraid nor be dismayed. Be strong and of good courage, for thus the Lord will do to all your enemies against whom you fight." And that, this doesn't even count the many other passages that have only one of these two words, or where a synonym for these two words is used in a command not to be terrified. God forbade them to be afraid or dismayed over and over and over and over and over again. And then when they see Goliath, they're afraid and dismayed. Do you understand that fear and dismay are forbidden to you? God has commanded you not to succumb to those emotions, at least in regard to this world. His command is not just suppress that emotion, however. His command is based on a logical grounds. Did you catch what the grounds were upon which we are not to fear? Because the Lord has set you up. Because the Lord is with you. Because the Lord gives victory. That is how you can reject dismay and fear. Because the Lord has set this up. Because the Lord is with you. Because the Lord gives victory. It's faith in the Lord that drives out that dismay and fear. Fear and dismay are attitudes that are going to lead to a stalemate. They're going to lead to you doing nothing. Saul was the biggest man in Israel physically. His ability in fighting was renowned. He was the natural one to engage this Philistine champion. And in fact, Jewish tradition has it that Goliath actually sent his first challenge to Saul before he opened it up to just any man. But Saul wouldn't take it up. Andrew Willett, commenting in the early 1600s, said, "Herein evidently appears the great change and alteration that was in Saul. How the Spirit of God had forsaken him, and of a valiant and courageous man, of a heroical spirit, he had grown to be a dastard and a coward. That whereas before in one day he had slain almost 40,000 of the Philistines, now he's 40 days together afraid at the sight of one Philistine. David, on the other hand, is able to act and break the stalemate because he was not afraid or intimidated, because he knew that the Lord was with him." The next section of chapter 17 reintroduces David and his family to us. David's three oldest brothers are all with Saul in the Valley of Elah, preparing for a battle with the Philistines, while David, the youngest son, is at home with dad and his sheep in Bethlehem in the hills inland. Where the other four brothers are, nobody knows. Well, why is David back home tending sheep? Wasn't he a retainer in Saul's court? Wasn't he an armor bearer? Some people say, well, this proves the Bible's full of mistakes. No, not necessarily. It's generally assumed that Saul sent David home when Saul went to the battle. That takes away any contradiction right there. Saul was apparently feeling well enough that he didn't need his harpist anymore, so sent him home. And as I've noted before, the word for armor bearer in chapter 16, when it says David was made Saul's armor bearer, the word for armor there is a word that has a wide range of meaning. It could just mean musical instruments. It could mean dinner dishes. It has a wide range of meaning, so it might not necessarily mean he was engaged with the weaponry at that point. Even if it was actually referring to armor, it was a practice for noblemen to have multiple armor bearers. Joab had 10 of them, according to 2 Samuel 18. So probably Saul had more experienced armor bearers that he would take with him than this greenhorn. Or perhaps the statement in chapter 16 that Saul made David his armor bearer, another possible explanation that reconciles it is maybe that's just jumping forward in time. And it's giving a second reason why Saul was kept in David was kept in Saul's court. But the story behind that was yet to be told in chapter 17. So there are lots of ways we can reconcile this. There's no need there's no way to prove an error in this. David, for the present, had returned to Bethlehem, had left the court. Saul had no further occasion to use him for the relief of his distemper. So David's there with his father. His father is of great age. And due to that age, he is an elder, and he's advanced from having to work in the fields and fight in the battles. He's advanced to being one of those men that sit at the gate and judge, or sits at home and people visit to ask questions. That was the status that his father was at. At some point during this 40-day standoff with the Philistines, Jesse sends David on a servant's errand to carry food to the battlefront, about 14 miles out east of Bethlehem, and to check in on his brothers, see how they're doing, bring back news. So David brings bread and grain to his brothers. The grain would have been roasted wheat or barley kernels, much like we would eat granola today. An ephah would be enough to feed 10 men for a day. The words in verse 18 are a little more obscure about what he was to bring to the commanding officer and what he was to take back home. To the brother's officer, he was a commanding officer in charge of 1,000 men, and there's a Jewish tradition, maybe it was even Jonathan. Jonathan, early in 1 Samuel, was put over 1,000 men. But David was to bring him literally 10 cuts of milk. I've read many commentaries and nobody has a full explanation for that. They just call it cheese. I wondered if it might have to do with churning for milk. But whatever it is, he's given that to the army captain. And then he is supposed to bring back home news or assurance or a pledge or a token or information about placement or companions for his brothers. There's a lot of different ways that word gets translated at the end of verse 18. Rabbi Kimchi was a Jewish commentator from the 1200s AD. He suggested that it meant David was to pay off any of his brothers' loans if they had to borrow food and supplies. And that's the way the Puritan commentators Matthew Henry and John Gill took it in the 1700s. If he pawned anything, if his brothers had pawned anything, he was to redeem it. I don't think that the verb lakach, to take, fits with that interpretation. The Vulgate from the 400s AD suggests that David was to observe who they associate with, what sort of life they had, report on how his brothers were behaving, basically. The oldest interpretation I found was from the Jewish Targums on 1 Samuel. It was written before the time of Christ. And they explained it meant to bring tidings of how they fare. And that interpretation makes the most sense to me. Bring back some sign of their welfare, like a letter from them. Robert Jamieson suggested that the token would be in the convenient form of a lock of their hair or a piece of their nail. I don't know if that would make me feel good about my son or not. But anyway, whatever it means, it gives us a little window into David's character. It means his father trusted him. Trusted him to gather news and communicate that news accurately. His father trusted him to manage possessions, perhaps, keep things out of hock. David was perceptive. He was honest. These are the things you want in a good communicator. His charge to look after the well-being of his brothers fits well with his charge to take care of sheep. He was a shepherd, not just because it was his job, but because he cared about other people. He wanted to make sure they were doing well. And his father understood the nature of this son and said, "This is a perfect errand for you, David. Go do it. Go check in on your brothers. Make sure they're all fine." David seems to be pretty excited about this. The way the story plays out, there seems to be a good bit of kind of newbie excitement to seeing a battlefront. He wakes up early and gets to the army camp, running around looking at everything, sees that Israel has set up a circular barricade. The soldiers are standing behind it, prepared to fight defensively if the Philistines attack. They've also have particular battle formations that they're arranged in. The Philistine army is there across the ravine. Both armies situated on hills to give the aggressor a disadvantage of having to attack uphill. If they're gonna, whoever takes the first initiative. There's food kept by a storekeeper, and David leaves his food with this guy. That would indicate maybe a centralized feeding of the troops rather than every man cooking food for himself. And as he gets there, the men are gathering in formation and shouting for the battle and whooping war cries. David is just taking all this in. This is exciting. Maybe there's parleying going on. Maybe there's recruiting and training of soldiers. Maybe some skirmishing. But the main point of the story points us at the main thing of Goliath showing up every morning, every evening, saying, "Send somebody to fight with me," and spewing out insults. And it's one of these speeches that captures David's full attention and calls him into action. Now, some people think that when David asked in verse 26, "What will be done concerning the man who's going to kill this Philistine?" that he was wondering how big a reward he could get. And he's sizing up, is it worth it? Would I make enough money if I did this? But he's already been told what the reward would be in the previous verse. So I don't think that's what he's asking. There's no indication that David was motivated by a desire for wealth. He was, every statement about what motivated him was his zeal for God's reputation. Saul was indeed offering rewards of becoming a son-in-law, being given a lot of money, and being exempted from paying taxes, or maybe of joining the nobility class. But when David comes before Saul, he doesn't mention any of that. And none of these things are conferred on him. In his conversation with the soldiers around verse 26, he only mentions Goliath's reproach against God. That's his motivation. I think David was saying in verse 26, "Hey, aren't we doing something about sending that man, a man that Goliath's asking for? Somebody's going, right? Are they? Aren't they? Yes, please. If not, I mean, I'll go, man. I'll volunteer if nobody else is going to do this." There's a question to search our own hearts with is, what motivates us for action? Is it our benefit or is it God's glory? Is what makes us get up and go the earthly, some earthly benefit, or is what makes us get up and go the fact that we believe we are advancing the glory of God in this earth? David asks in verse 26, "Who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should disgrace the armies of the living God?" The circumcision is pointing to the status of relationship with God. David is circumcised because he has a relationship with God, and that's defined by the covenants in the Old Testament law. Goliath has no such relationship with God. He has no law that he abides by. He has no recognition of God as his God. And so that's why David brings this word in. It's speaking of the status of relationship with God. Why should someone like that? Why should we allow someone like that to disgrace the armies of the living God? The rest of the men are just trying to ignore Goliath's taunts. David's taking it personally that he would blaspheme God. He sees God's people are married to God, and so for him to insult God's people is for Goliath to insult God, and David is not going to stand for that. In our culture today, are we grieved when a movie star takes the name of our Lord in vain? Or when a professor denies his existence? Or when a radical group makes fun of Christians? David did not passively ignore it. He wanted all the earth to know that there is a God in Israel. May God help us to be zealous and courageous for the glory of his name like David was. David's question, I think, needles his big brother. He's, one of y'all is going out to fight that man, right? Well, no, not really. And Eliab is embarrassed by his own fear of volunteering to fight Goliath. Perhaps Eliab's already jealous because he'd been passed over when David got anointed. And now David has a place in the court close to Saul. Eliab is just one of 1,000 soldiers under an army commander. So, as is often the case, when someone feels ashamed and wanting to protect himself, they cast accusations, projecting his own weakness upon the person who's making him feel ashamed. That's human nature. His accusation that David negligently left the sheep without a shepherd and came to the battlefront for selfish reasons reveals to us Eliab's own heart. Eliab would have done it. He would have abandoned the sheep and gone to the battlefield for his own entertainment. That's why he thought to accuse David of it. David, however, came because his dad told him to, and David had responsibly recruited a shepherd to fill in for him while he was gone, so the accusation was false. If there's one thing that's more intimidating than a giant, it's a big brother. What have I done now, says David. It suggests that Eliab's scoldings were not an infrequent experience. But David doesn't let his brother's rebuke dampen his zeal. There is always going to be, even brothers and sisters in Christ, who see you stepping out in faith to further God's kingdom and will accuse you of some impure motive. Or at least they'll use worldly wisdom to discourage you from taking the course of action God's calling you to take. We need to be careful about judging other people's motives. It's all too easy to project our own sinful motives on others and condemn them in order to make ourselves feel better and totally miss what's actually going on. David answers in verse 29, "What have I done now? Isn't this the issue?" Or literally, is it not a word? I think he's refusing to get sidetracked with defending himself. He's saying, the issue at hand is the vindication of the shame which Goliath is bringing upon God's people. I'm not going to sash you back, big brother. I'm not gonna explain why you're wrong. I'm staying focused on the important thing here. This is the issue. God is being dishonored, and we need to do something about this. So he keeps on inquiring as to whether anybody has any plans to combat Goliath. Are you going? Who's going to do this? Eliab would rather Goliath triumph over Israel than David be the man that triumphs over him. Matthew Henry commented, "The more threatening the church's enemies are, the more forbearing her friends should be with one another." David would not be driven off from his thoughts of engaging the Philistine by the ill will of his brother. Those that undertake great and public services must not think it strange if they be discountenanced and opposed by those from whom they had reason to expect support and assistance. But they must go humbly on with their work in the face not only of their enemies' threats, but their friends' slights and suspicions. The more threatening the church's enemies are, the more forbearing the friends of the church should be with one another. Let's encourage and support one another rather than accuse one another of wrong motives. I'm going to have to pause the story for now. The sermon was kind of long today. But I hope you'll consider the attitudes that David brought to the table to break this stalemate. He kept focused on God's glory. He didn't get distracted, even when he was criticized. David wasn't willing to just live with insults against God and his people. He wasn't willing to just put up with it. And he was not afraid. He was not afraid because he believed God had set things up, God was with him, and God was going to give the victory. I encourage you with those things to yourselves. Stay focused on God's glory. Don't focus on how big the giant is and what his armor is. Focus on the glory of God instead. Focus on the glory of God instead of on that sin that's whipping your butt. Focus on the glory of God instead of the power of the systems of injustice and evil in this world. Focus on the glory of God. And when you take steps of obedience to God and you catch flack for it, don't waste lots of time defending yourself against it. Stay focused on the task God has given you to do. And work to give glory to God. Don't be like the frog in the kettle that just puts up with the water as it gets hotter and hotter and hotter until suddenly he's dead. Recognize what is evil and call it evil. Don't just accept, well, this is just the way it is. It doesn't have to be this is the way it is. God can use you to bring change in this world. You're not going to make the world perfect. Jesus is going to do that before long. But God can and will use you to make some things right in this world. And don't be afraid. Trust that God has set this situation up for you, for your maturity and to grow you in your faith and to make you more like him. God has set this situation up for you. This is an opportunity for you to trust him. Will you believe God is with you? And then will you act with obedient faith in whatever God calls you to do, trusting that God, through his power, is the one who gives victory.